Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering radiation cancer treatment from over 30 physicians at 20 locations in the Charlotte regional area. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson. And from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. If you know much about fashion, you probably know the name Laura Vinroot Poole. The fashion business definitely knows about her. She's a common presence in the houses of designers all over the world. She owns three boutiques in Charlotte, and her flagship store, Capital, has now been around for 20 years. But Laura Vinroot Poole didn't plan on going into fashion. The path of her life has surprised her the same way it surprised her family and friends. It all came from one strong desire to get back home. Here's our conversation. So, Laura Vinroot Poole.
Tommy Tomlinson.
How are you?
I'm well.
Do you remember the first article of clothing that you ever loved?
I don't know that I remember the first article I really loved, but I remember since I was a little girl, I mean little, every Christmas, my dad would take me to Montaldo's, and we would pick out my mother's Christmas present, which was always a church suit.
Yeah, Montaldo's was like the big department store, one of the big ones in Charlotte at the time, right?
The most incredible. And it was downtown or uptown where the Mint Museum had their craft and design museum, and it was this absolutely beautiful, special store. So we would do, every Christmas, we would do a church suit, a peignoir set. And a piece of art. And so probably as a 4-year-old, he took me and I started to pick out. And so I think that I was editing very early in my life.
I have to, this will be the first of many times I proclaim my ignorance. I don't know what a peignoir set is.
Peignoir set is a, well, it's lingerie. I mean, it's a nightgown with a matching robe.
Okay. And
I think it's actually interesting you ask what my favorite piece of clothing is, and I answered that way is because this store is not because I love clothes. This store is because I think I love Charlotte. And I think that I wanted to make a difference here, and it was totally opportunistic. I mean, I came here out of college, and there was nowhere to shop. And all of my mom's friends, it was sort of the way you did it was a couple of times a year you went to New York, usually in the fall, especially to shop at Bergdorf Goodman or Saks Fifth Avenue. You would go to Neiman's in Atlanta, or you would go to Bob Ellis in Charleston, and they had the best shoes in the world. And so that was sort of the fashion pilgrimage of all of my mother's friends. And there really wasn't other than, and Montaldo's closed, I would say, in the late 80s. So there really wasn't a place to shop, and I thought how strange that was that you have Bank of America based here and Herc Celanese and, you know, NASCAR, all of these things here, and nobody could actually shop to go to the events around these businesses. So that was really more the impetus to open the business than me loving clothes, for sure.
Well, I do remember reading that at one point, I guess when you were 15 or so, you went off to boarding school in Massachusetts,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
I think I remember you saying, you're never coming back.
Yeah.
And I guess what I wondered is, did you mean at the time, I'm never coming back to this place, or I'm not coming back to the South? Like, what did, in your mind, what did never coming back mean?
I think that, at that time, well, first of all, so I grew up, my dad was on city council for 10 years. He was the mayor for 2 terms, which is, it's not a huge thing, but in a small person's life, it is sort of all, there's a lot of focus on it. And so it's a lot of pressure as the child of somebody who is a public figure. Even, and really, Charlotte was a small town then. So you could feel all of the eyes on you. But I also grew up across the street from Hugh McCall. I grew up behind Harry and Mary Dalton, who essentially created, the modern Mint Museum with their collection. The Crutchfields were great family friends of First Union. So I think that it was like, I definitely felt, which was something that really formed me and my commitment to Charlotte and service, but it also felt sort of tight and felt, it's hard to be a kid and make mistakes and you know, I knew I was basically, when I left, I knew I was going to get in trouble if I stayed. So I felt like I needed to go as far away as, you know, outside of Boston. And yeah, I think never coming back because it was stifling, you know, it was stifling for people to watch what you were doing and judge what you're doing. And I needed the freedom. And at the same time, once I got there, I pretty quickly learned that I wanted to come home.
So let me recenter people who are not in Charlotte listening to this, or maybe don't know like the more recent history. Right. Hugh McColl, the guy you mentioned, is the former CEO of Bank of America.
Right.
Which was NCNB, North Carolina National Bank. Ed Crutchfield ran First Union, which became Wachovia, which now became part of Wells Fargo.
Yep.
And your dad, Richard Venrude, played basketball at UNC for Dean Smith, was mayor of Charlotte, Morehead Scholar.
Yep.
And ran for governor here, really well-known and respected in town. Yes. So that's the circles you were traveling in, and you felt like that was kind of putting you in a box a little bit.
Well, I think that it was very influential on me, but at the same time, at 15, you know, you have some things you want to try out and, personalities probably you want to try out. And it's really hard to do it when a lot of people are watching.
What personalities were you trying out?
I don't know. Hippie chick, you know. I don't know. New England intellectual. I have no idea. I think I just wanted the freedom to figure out really who I was.
And did going to boarding school give you that freedom?
Absolutely, it did. It was this place that really showed me that anything is possible. And I went to Andover, which is a fantastic school outside of Boston. And you're with people from all over the world. I mean, I had one roommate was from New Hampshire, two were from Hong Kong. The Aga Khan went there. Lachlan Murdoch was a classmate of mine.
Is that Rupert Murdoch's kid?
Yeah. I mean, and then you have, it's just a really, it's a special place. And so I think that that was the first, other than growing up with all of those people around me in Charlotte, it just made me understand that literally anything is possible. Whatever I want to do, I can figure out how to do it. And that, because I saw so many things, but also because I think it's a hard experience. And so I think also getting through that made me understand that anything's possible.
And when did you start figuring out what you wanted to do?
I don't know. I came back, I went to Chapel Hill, and I very quickly, I made my debut in Raleigh in the North Carolina debutante ball, and the next day I went on a NOLS semester, the National Outdoor Leadership School. So I hiked for 3 months, had 3 showers in 3 months. I did a
your typical debutante.
Did a semester at Penland in the mountains of North Carolina.
The big art school. Yeah.
And then taught art classes to children at Spirit Square, which is our arts organization, sort of like the McCall Center, the earlier version of that. I dropped out of Carolina because I went to Carolina for Chapel Hill for a year for my freshman year, and I found it really hard to fold back into the people I had grown up with and sort of the person I was supposed to be, because I really wasn't. I didn't feel that anymore because I'd seen a lot of things and experienced a lot of things at Andover that, maybe they hadn't been out of Charlotte, it felt like.
I was going to say, did Chapel Hill kind of feel provincial to you?
Yeah, it really did when I first got there. And then I took that year off, and my dad didn't talk to me for a year. He sort of, every time he saw me, he was not happy with me. and then I came back and sort of came back on my own terms, came back and joined the art department. And that just changed everything for me. Quit the sorority, quit all of the things that I thought I was supposed to do, that I had been raised to do, and really, became my own person. And so I guess that was when I don't think I was particularly interested in clothing at that time, but I was interested in beautiful things, and I was interested in, I think as the process of a charrette, which is, when you defend your work, you have to defend every mark that you've made. And so I really learned to have a reason for everything I did.
There's another word I don't know, charrette?
Charrette is...
what is that?
A charrette is a critique.
Okay. And if you're like an art major or something, it's like defending your thesis.
But you do it every single day. So you have, the class that or at least once a week, but it's the teacher probably every, the professor every day is asking you, why did you make that red mark there? Why is this, you know, all of that stuff. And so you have to be really deliberate about everything you do. And I think that I felt like that alone prepared me for my career as much as anything in my whole life.
What kind of art were you making then?
Painting. Yeah.
And what drew you into painting?
Abstract landscapes, but abstract also interiors. I did a whole series on Graceland and Elvis.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And was that did that come from going to Graceland? And
it came from, you know, that all of that. I think I had a professor at Carolina who said that, you know, it's the people that are one step out of the South that really love the South. And I think that it's, you know, the people that have never left have a hard time understanding why they love it. And I think that Andover experience really made me recommit and just love it and want to take care of it and want to, just want to treat it in the right way.
So when you were up there,
yeah,
and you talked about this wanting to go back, what did you miss?
Well, first of all, you know, up there, like my first day of school, you know, somebody said, oh, you're from North Carolina. I know somebody from Texas. Do you know? I'm like, what? But, you know, invariably, I actually did know the family.
So not that far-fetched, yeah.
But I missed, I missed the warmth. I missed the love. I missed the beauty. I missed the graciousness. I missed everything. I mean, you know, I missed everything.
I kind of jumping ahead on what I was thinking here, but do you, obviously people can recognize a Southern accent.
Yeah.
And some of us who've been around a while can recognize variations,
sure.
Like where they're from. Can you recognize a Southern style at all? Like if you see somebody come in the room, can you make a pretty good guess where they're from or something?
Yes, I can.
And what goes into that?
Well, I mean, I think the thing about Southerners is that they're very sure about who they are. And you hear that from the day you're born. In my house, you did. Remember who you are. Remember where you're from. Meaning, like, behave. don't embarrass us, kind of. But I think that I really think we're different in that way that we – I think a Southern woman is happy to be, if not prefers to be, noticed. They want to be the center of attention, or they want to be the most beautiful girl in the room. And I don't know that that's typical.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, you go to New York and everybody's wearing black. So there's something to that.
Right.
And I think that has been interesting in fashion for me, because we show up to these in Paris, like somewhere like Paris. I mean, literally every single person in the whole city is wearing gray or black. and the weather's that way. I mean, the weather's dark and dank and depressing and rainy. And my team, we walk in and we're all wearing hot pink and turquoise. And
you have plumage, right?
Yeah, and everybody's like, who are these people?
I want to talk about New York and Paris and all these places. Yeah. But I want to kind of circle back to you're at Chapel Hill.
Yeah.
You're doing art. And then where does this path kind of verge in this direction?
Right out of college, I worked on one of my dad's campaigns for governor, gubernatorial campaigns, which was fascinating. And we went to, you know, all 100 counties in North Carolina and just learned a lot about people in the state and how special the state is. And then I got married. While my dad was running for governor, in fact, I eloped, and it's another year that he didn't talk to me for an entire year and probably cried every time he saw
me. Like, was there any indication you were going to get married?
Not really.
Before this happened?
Not really. I just didn't, you know, my dad was running for governor, and I think I didn't want a wedding with 800 people. And my husband wanted to come to UNC Chapel Hill, I'm sorry, UNC Charlotte, to study architecture. He was far along in another career, but he'd always wanted to be an architect. And this was the program he wanted to study in. And so I was sort of like, I don't really know what I will do here. And just from visiting, and I thought, and really it was a personal thing, like, I don't know where I'm going to shop. And then it just sort of connected to me, like I told you, that, you know, none of my mom's friends shopped here. There was literally nowhere to shop. Mm-hmm. So it was more just an opportunity, and nobody gave us any money. I mean, we didn't, you know, it was completely made up on our end, and that, you know, we physically built it ourselves. We went to New York and we convinced people that we had this great business that was going to start, and we had $0. I mean, it was not, but it was just a lot of charming and talking and really believing that this could happen.
Now, was that because, I mean, did you do it that way because you wanted to do it that way? Or did you do it that way because
you didn't
feel like other people, I guess what I'm getting around to, did your family think this was some crazy thing you were doing?
Yeah, well, I've learned that just along the way, that it's not a great idea to, even people you really love, even the closest people in your life, when you want to do risky things, to ask them their opinion.
Because they might tell you?
They might tell you, but they almost always say, I don't think that's a good idea, because people that love you don't want you to get hurt. They don't want you to be disappointed. And so I have very rarely heard yes in my career, that yes, super idea. And so I've just sort of, I don't know, I've had that whole editing thing since I was a little girl. I've just had, when I have conviction in something and I believe it can happen, and I create it and make it happen.
Yeah. So how old were you when you came back?
I was 24.
24. So it had been 9 years since you went off and said you were never coming back.
Right.
By the time you came back, did you want to be back?
I really did. And I think it had a little bit to do with that Andover experience and, you know, people saying, oh, you're from North Carolina. I think Jesse Helms is from there. And you're like, okay, that's sort of simplifying it, you know.
Yeah.
It's a little more interesting than that.
Yeah.
And just really, you know, like something I wanted to truly take care of. And it's a little of that, you know, hornet's nest of rebellion kind of thing that we were all brought up in here. Like, you want to show people and you want to be, you know, you want to say, guess what? We're not who you think we are. I mean, I love to be underestimated. It's my favorite thing.
Because you can always, you feel like you can deliver.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I over-deliver. I mean, I like that. I think that people are so shocked at the things that we sell in the store, the collections and the clientele that we have, and I'm not. I think it's a really sophisticated place, actually, and I think it is sophisticated because you have so many people from other places here, and it's a very educated community, and they travel well, and they travel over the world. Even something, it's funny to say, but even those the people involved in NASCAR, I mean, they travel every single weekend. They're very sophisticated.
And very wealthy.
We that too. I don't know. Yeah.
Many of them.
Probably.
Yes.
Yeah. No, but I mean, they've seen things. So I think
sure.
that this is one of my favorite stories about NASCAR. And one of my great friends is married to a big driver, and I love telling her the story that when I was at Andover, we were in the common room on a Saturday or Sunday. And watching television, and we were watching NASCAR, and these are my friends from Hong Kong. And they were like, what is this? And I said, oh, I think it's NASCAR. I'd never been to a race, you know, growing up. And I said, I don't even know what that is. They said, this is crazy. What is this? And I said, I don't know. I've never been to that. And all of a sudden, it's the opening thing, and it's in Charlotte. And my dad comes off of like a helicopter in the middle of the thing. They were like, Laura, isn't that your dad? Like, oh, yeah, I guess it is. But it's funny to have started that way. And then I'm so protective of NASCAR. I'm so protective of everything about this place. I'm so protective of.
Yeah.
Because of that, people thinking that we're just a simple sort of, you know, that you could explain us in one sentence. Oh, they're rednecks, or oh, they're simple, or, you know, we're really not.
When we come back, Laura Van Rupel talks about how the recession almost destroyed her clothing business and how she came back. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, I'm Nick Delacanal. Are you a curious person, always questioning the world around you? Then check out WFAE's FAQ City podcast, where we investigate listener-submitted questions and get to the bottom of anything and everything you may be curious about in the Charlotte area. Check us out and submit your own questions you need answers to at wfae.org/FAQ City.
So when you decided to start Capital,
yes,
you had no special experience with
none
designer.
Did you? I'll tell you, I did have experience growing up because my mother never gave me any budget for clothing, and I learned everything from shopping at the Junior League thrift shop. I mean, I really did. I had an incredible wardrobe, and it was all from Junior League thrift.
Now, what did you learn there?
You learn form and how things are made, and you learn about beautiful clothes. And they were the most beautiful clothes in Charlotte, truly.
Always the Goodwill, right, or
yeah,
somewhere like that.
Right.
So did you feel like at that time you had like kind of an instinctive idea about what worked, or was it like a lot of trial? I mean, do you remember stuff you wore? Then now you go, oh, God, I can't believe it.
Oh, no, I remember everything I've ever worn probably. But I do think one of the things that I had, and probably one of the bigger reasons that I opened the business, was that growing up, I always was really close to my mom's friends. And it was all older women were always, I just had close relationships with them. And they always counted on me to fix them. You know, I would always sort of modernize the way they had their scarf tied or fix their pin, put it in the right place.
Now, why did they ask you to do that?
I don't know. I think I did it probably, or I just had, it had always been sort of what we did. I was just sort of always like that. And to be honest, you know, I mean, I opened the store at 25. And my clients were 45. I mean, it wasn't a bunch of young things. I mean, it was my mom's friends. And
yeah. You know, and, so that's what I'm interested in, you know, coming into this without any particular training, let's say.
No.
But knowledge. How do you decide, like, what to do? Like that first, from zero to opening, like, how'd you figure that out?
I made it up, but I...
Well, that's an answer to
it. I make it up every day, but I also think that that actually, for me, really is the key, is that you don't have to have some sort of great training in clothing. I think you have to have a great training in Charlotte and in social events and, you know, what people do and what's appropriate to wear to certain things. And I think it's also a Southern thing in that it's just basic manners, you know, and that Southerners turn themselves out. Like, you don't show up to an event unless you are turned out. It's rude. I mean, if you're not wearing, of occasion, the correct outfit, you know what I mean? If it's a black tie wedding and you show up in a day dress, it's not polite. It's not a money thing. It's just like it's just respect to the hostess, really. And so I think that I did know, and I do know now. And I also think that's why we've been successful, is that we didn't have, you know, I didn't go up to New York or go to Europe and tell, you know, have them tell me, oh, this is all the rage. You have to have this. I came to them and said, you know, these are our events. This is our lifestyle. And this is what I will be buying from you, because you don't know me. You don't know the South. You don't know where we live. And so you're not going to tell me what to do.
Right.
And again, to that hornet's nest of rebellion. I mean, I think that, yeah, there is something about that. I don't know.
So I am curious about when you go on these buying trips.
Yeah.
So how does that work? Do you have a list of stuff already that you know you need to get? Or do you go there and just see what appeals to you? I mean, how does that generally work?
We see 300 collections every season, from New York to London to Paris to Milan, L.A.
And is there like a time of year when you're doing all that?
At this point, it's kind of all year, but there are four distinct seasons. And so, yes, I know. I mean, I know what's going on in Charlotte. I know the opera galas at this time. I know that this is wedding season. I know, you know, all that kind of thing. I know that climate is like this, you know, and I mean, for fall for us, you know, you have 2 months of cold weather.
Right.
So I have to adjust all of those things so that the market, so that it reflects our market.
And how far out are you? Like, you know, we're in April right now.
Yeah.
What are you thinking about?
So I will start in a couple of weeks buying Resort, which is November, start shipping, which is, you know, really like summer dresses starting in November. That was when they'll ship.
Okay.
But I don't even know what I'm looking at anymore. Like, you kind of can't even, you just, I think, and also, you know, people don't really buy that way anymore. I mean, people buy things they love when they love them, and they keep them in their closet and want to wear them, so you can find ways to do it.
So it's not as much of a seasonal thing as it used to be.
It's not. And it's so funny also because, I mean, my mother, every time I get home from market, is like, well, tell me what are the, what are the skirt lengths? What are the colors? And I'm always, I have absolutely no idea because it's just not how we do things.
Well, see, this is terrible because I was going to ask you to educate everybody on like what's hot this summer.
Well, I don't think no.
And because people, I'm sure at least some people are going to be tuning in like, please, Laura, help me.
No. I think that it's a overall trend in fashion, but it's always been a trend at Capital with us is just personal expression. And it's not about looking like something somebody else wants you to look like. It's about looking like yourself. And that's all. But really, that is literally all for us.
I am curious, though, on not seeing it from the inside.
Yeah.
So, I see photos from like the Fashion Week or whatever.
Right.
And I see these impossible models who right. I've never seen their
they are.
Bodies.
No, they're 16 years old from,
right.
Yeah, Chuckles of Oz.
I've never seen them in the real world.
Right.
Wearing clothes that I've never seen anybody wear in the real world.
Right.
And I don't understand how that happens.
Yeah.
And then it filters down to something that you right. or somebody might be selling in their stores.
So I think there's a different, somebody said it recently, like, well, I mean, the store is all about you, right? And I said, it's literally like not even a little bit about me. If it were about me, it would be navy cashmere sweaters and old Levi's. I mean, that's and clogs. That's not a business.
Right.
So when you see things on the runway, what you're doing is, what I'm doing is thinking of every one of my clients, and I'm interpreting that collection to say, you know what? I actually think Lisa could wear that to this event, and I think it would be perfect. It's that translation and interpretation from me to my clients all along the way. It really has nothing to do with me other than I'm interpreting it for them.
Yeah. Also from the outside, and I think this is obviously filtered through movies and stuff. I see something like The Devil Wears Prada, yeah. or even Zoolander or something like that.
It's actually quite like that.
I was going to say,
yeah.
I feel like there's a... From what I've seen, there's like a high diva quotient.
Huge.
Is that so?
Huge. And I think that's another reason that that we've been successful, because I think that fashion, and especially luxury fashion, is totally exclusive. And I have never looked at it like that. I've always tried to make it inclusive from top to bottom, from when I travel. I mean, I sort of think of it as this importing and exporting of culture, and that, I have 12 appointments a day. And in those 12 appointments, each time I'm selling Charlotte. I'm selling my client, and I'm selling Charlotte to that designer brand, and then bringing their clothes in to sell. So it's for me, it is like a civic duty thing. But I don't know that everybody thinks of it that way. There's a lot of self-importance and a lot of do you know who I am? And
right.
I would think that if you asked anybody, that I know that I'm not known to be that kind of a person. I mean, for me, it's all about relationships. And for me, the recession was the thing that really taught me that. I mean, growing up and growing up around those people made me understand that it's all about relationships. But it wasn't. And the first 10 years of my business were fast and furious, and I was successful without trying. And then the recession hit in 2008, and we almost went out of business really seriously. And that was when I realized how important my relationships with my clients, but also with my vendors, and also realized, thank goodness, that was important to me for this past 10 years, because they do love me and we love each other and they want to work with me, whereas they didn't do that with other people across the country. I mean, the specialty stores from when I started to now are at least in half. I mean, and department stores are really, really hurting and if not going out of business.
Yeah. So walk me through what happened in the recession. I mean, when you said that the relationships mattered to people, like basically give you credit or something?
It's actually hard to understand, but it's quite interesting that, so back to the how far out do you have to order? It's about 6 months. So we were in Europe in October of 2008, ordering millions of dollars worth of inventory. And while we were there, we found out that Wachovia went out of business. So you've already ordered that. You've already signed your name to, I am good for this. This is what I'm ordering, $5 million worth of inventory, whatever it is. And that it's yours. So 5 months, 6 months from then, it's going to deliver. And we didn't have any clients. I mean, my clients were Wachovia wives. And
hey, were they like leaving town, or they just running out of money?
It wasn't that. It was almost like a Marie Antoinette situation. You know, it was like you didn't want to be seen shopping. And also an event, it was not polite to be at events and be in a full-on sequin dress. I mean, in poor taste, I guess. It's just like...
Right.
Certainly people cut their spending, because the other thing is, leading up to the recession, people were acting insane. I mean, people were buying the same dress for each of their houses, you know. It was just really excessive. That looking back, you know, I feel like we should have seen it, because and I do remember feeling this way. It was behavior that I wasn't comfortable with, and it was behavior that I didn't grow up with. But, you know, the client is the client, and you do everything you can to make them happy. But it was just things that you could tell were not the right thing to do. So people curbing their spending in half, I mean, that just decimated us. It killed us. And then e-commerce started, and that killed us also, because the department stores slashed their prices months before we all agree to go on sale, essentially. I mean, there's a sort of set time when designers say sale should start on this date for everybody in the U.S. You know, Europe has its own dates as well. I mean, they're much later than
sale. You mean for like the new season of clothes or something? Or?
So the fall season goes on sale, I think it's, you know, around Thanksgiving. So that year, Neiman Marcus and whoever, all the new e-commerce sites, they went probably 40% off. I'm sorry, 60% off, like in September. So you've received your clothes. You got the clothes for 3 weeks or something, and now you all of a sudden have to sell them at 60% off, because the clients would come in and say, "I saw this online for 60% off. Will you honor it?" And, you know, like, what do you say?
Right.
I mean, you try to get we tried to get whatever we could out of it, because we also had no idea how long it would last. I mean, we had no understanding of what was happening.
Right.
Other than we knew we were going to, and that we did owe a ton of money to vendors, and didn't know how we were going to pay them back. I mean, that was also when I created my e-commerce site. We created a thing called House Account and added specialty stores all across the country. It, you know, at one point had 250 stores across the country to help them to sell online, because we knew that you couldn't do it on your own. You couldn't compete with Neiman Marcus. But if we all banded together and had this e-commerce together, that we could be successful, or at least halfway compete. The recession was, I remember telling somebody, I wish I'd gone to business school, because I have no idea what I'm doing and it's really scary.
Right.
And they said, "You don't need to go to business school. Like, this is the best business school you could ever go to."
Going to teaching business school.
Yeah, exactly. Become a professor in recession survival.
Yeah.
But that was kind of back to that Andover thing. Like, I don't know, that really showed me my strength and my ability to survive. I had 30 employees. And that, more than anything, was what was scary for me, is that I had all of these people that depended on me to stay solvent and to keep them working. And we all love what we do, and we all really wanted to be there. And so we got together and said, how are we going to survive this? But also, how are we going to compete with e-commerce, with these giants of Neiman Marcus and Saks Fifth Avenue? And we decided that we have three things that nobody else can ever compete with us. One is our physical location. The store is beautiful. My husband designed it, and it's a really special place. That it's a complete escape from reality. And two, our service is unparalleled. I mean, we do anything for our clients. We, you know, fly out to California to zip them up for a special occasion. We send their dry cleaning to New York every week. We plan their outfits for the week. We'll do whatever. And we also, during the recession, decided that instead of them coming to the store, we would go to them. So we travel to them and work in their closets with them, in their wardrobes. And then the third thing that we have that nobody else can compete with us is our edit, that we ruthlessly edit every collection. We work harder than anybody at that. So whereas...
And when you say edit, what do you mean
so
by that?
So it means those 300 collections we see every season. You know, it would be a lot easier if I saw 100 collections a season. That would make my travel a lot smaller and less, but the store wouldn't be able to compete with Neiman Marcus or the bigger stores. But the other thing is that when you go to a collection, say if you go into Yves Saint Laurent, there are 1,000 pieces that they show you, 1,000 pieces of clothing that you can choose from. And I might choose 10. that I think are relevant for Charlotte women. Whereas I think other people will say why don't we just do these 50 and call it a day? But I just think that we are hyper focused on our clients and their lives, and not ours, on their lives and what's going to be relevant to them in our climate with their lifestyle, all of those things.
So what did you learn during that recession time that you carry through now?
That I'm a warrior. truly, that I'm a warrior, that I can, we owed millions of dollars to vendors and all over the world, and that I can figure out a way to survive, and a will to survive. And I think that, and also I think I learned that this is what I really want to do. Because if I hadn't, I would have been like, you know what, let's just shut it down.
Yeah.
And also what a gift it is to love what you do, because I think people spend their whole lives trying to figure that out. And somehow out of the blue, I figured it out from the get-go.
Right.
And I think because I know that my love, yes, I love beautiful clothes and beautiful things. But I think that what I really love is serving people, serving women specifically. For 20 years it has been. And the last three with men, with our men's store. But I love to help people feel better about themselves. I love to have people feel more confident and to walk into the room and feel like they should be there and that they are the most relevant person in the room and have the most interesting things to say and all of those things. Like I'm a background person, but I'm a real cheerleader for my clients.
Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people, right, when this stuff comes up in conversation, which I have to say, not a ton, but it does come up occasionally. I know a lot of people who I hear say, I just don't know what my style is or what it should be or whatever. Mm-hmm. I imagine there are a lot of people listening to this,
yeah,
who have never quite figured out, mm-hmm, you know, what they should be wearing or what they feel best in or whatever. How would you suggest somebody go about figuring that out?
I think finding a person that's not related to you, I mean, family or friend. I think to find a great consultant, like a great salesperson. I think the thing about what we do and what a great salesperson can do, or stylist, is that they can let you know how you're appearing to other people, help you to understand context, and that, you know, wearing that outfit that's down to your navel is making you not look very smart. or whatever those things are. I think it's just giving you perspective on what you're showing the world, which I think sometimes is hard to see on your own.
Well, that raises an interesting question, what you just said. Is there a common sort of direction that you have to nudge people? Do you often have to nudge people into wearing something a little more conservative, or do you have to nudge them sometimes into being a little more daring? Or
I mean, the daring, yeah. Well, I mean, I think one of the things that I know is that, you know, we're 6,000 square feet. It's a very small store in the scheme of the volume we do, or the, you know, the people that are similar to us across the country in Dallas or New York or L.A. And this is something my dad taught me growing up, that if everybody likes you, you're doing something wrong. And that always kind of scared me when I was little, because, you know, it's hard as a child of a politician. You hear, you know, a lot, even not even a child, running for governor, it's really, really painful to hear bad things about your family, about your dad, because you know they're not true, and you know that that's not the person that in real life it is. And so that was always really painful for me. But I understand it now. I mean, I really do understand it, because I there are a lot of people that don't like my store and don't like my taste level and don't like the clothes we carry. And that's okay with me. I'm not gonna make everybody happy. There are enough people that I make really, really happy that I'm fine.
So this is the 20th year, right?
Yes.
And you have this anniversary,
yes,
collection. I noticed that one of the items, and it is a clutch, I guess, that has the cover of Thomas Wolfe's Look Homeward, Angel.
Yeah.
So is that something, was that,
that
something
was
you had something to do,
yeah,
with?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And why that?
Well, this is a really famous designer named Olympia Letan out of Paris. And her father is a pretty famous illustrator named Pierre Letan. And she started these book clutches, I don't know, 5 or 10 years ago. And she does all remakes in felt, sews and felt and embroidery classic book covers. And she'd never done a Thomas Wolfe nor this one. And so obviously it was important to me because we wanted to connect it to North Carolina. We also have cashmere sweaters embroidered with Esse Quam Videre,
which
is our state motto, to be rather than to seem.
Right. I've heard you talk about that or seen you talk about that several times.
Yeah.
That's really important to me. Why is that?
I think it's that back to the Andover thing. Like, I think it's, you know, as a 15-year-old leaving home and remembering that, remember who you are, remember where you're from. I think no matter where you are, probably at 15 or 16, you can lose yourself. And that was just an important motto for me, really, to remember home, but also just to remember who I am, that who I am is enough, you know, and I am from North Carolina, and it's not only enough, it's everything for me.
Yeah. And as you started this business, you know, what kind of advice did your dad or your family give you about it?
Nobody gave me any advice, you know. No, because they didn't want, I mean, I think people didn't really want me to do it. It was scary. So I don't think I've gotten any great advice other than, I do remember working for my dad's campaign and seeing him at 2 o'clock in the morning making phone calls, I think, or something, or I've never seen a person work so hard in my life. And I'll be like, Daddy, this is too much. Like, you need to go home. And he said, no, I'm not going to get through this race I'm not going to have anybody outwork me. I'm not going to have anybody say I didn't work harder than everybody else. And he did. And so I think that for me in starting the business, that was the one thing I really knew. I knew how to work hard, and I knew that nobody would outwork me. And I feel that way. I mean, when I travel to Europe with these, you know, to be honest, it's sort of a young person's profession in that I've exhausted many assistants, buying assistants. And so they're almost always in their early 20s. And these poor young gals will just be like, oh, my God, this is miserable. This is not glamorous. And like, let's keep on going. You know, this is what it is. You have to be a warrior. You absolutely have to be a warrior to be successful at this and to want to do it.
So at what point did it sort of catch on with your dad or your family that this was a good thing and it was going to work?
I don't know. I don't know that it ever has. I mean, I don't come from a family that's very, we don't talk about success or what is success? I mean, success for me means that I have successful people working with me. You know, success for me means when, you know, one of the women I work with buys a house for herself. I mean, what really is success? So they've never said, congratulations, good job, you still have a job. I mean, that's just not the kind of family I grew up in. I think for us, it's more about being a good person and giving back to the community.
I remember reading at one point you felt like, because you were interested in the arts and because that you felt like somehow that wasn't as substantial.
Yeah, I come from a family of givers. I mean, I think you know my brother. I mean, from my dad being the mayor and being on city council, I mean, you're not paid for that. I think there was a salary for mayor, but my dad always donated it back. So it's not like you don't do that for money.
And your brother is an ER doctor and has been all over the world.
Doctors Without Borders, right. And he volunteered for the Navy and has been in Afghanistan and Djibouti and all over the world.
And I know from talking to your brother that he has always felt like he needed to live up to kind of his dad's promise.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess I wonder if you felt the same way.
I did. And I mean, I always have felt that way. It's a hard, you know, it's hard to come from successful parents and it's hard to, because you can never live up to that. I mean, I have a lot of friends who are professional athletes here. And I think about that. It's hard for the children to grow up in that shadow. And so I think for my brother and for me and my sister, she was a book editor. And she worked with the Center for Southern Culture, and she's done these amazing things for the South. And my mom was on Barium Spring, Salvation Army, all of these boards. I mean, I think, and also, you know, went to Mills and taught people to read. She has her master's in adult education. It was hard for me to understand how an art major, a painting major, you know, can make sense in this family. And this family, again, is not just this family. This family's also Hugh McCall, and it's also Harry and Mary Dalton and the Crutchfields. And it's like, how do you contribute back to this world and make it better than when you came to it. And it wasn't until, I don't know, maybe 5 or 10 years in that I realized that I was giving back and that I was serving my community, not only my clients, but for me, one of the biggest things now is serving the young men and women that work with me and helping them to develop their careers and their lives. And so I don't know what that moment was, mm-hmm. but I didn't tell my parents about it and say, guess what, I did.
I finally figured it out. Yeah.
But for me, it did connect for me that all of a sudden I was like, wow, I do think I'm doing it in my own way, and I'm an artist, and I'm an extrovert, and I'm not going into politics, and I'm not going to be a doctor, but that's okay because I am. Being myself.
Yeah. Obviously, most of the people who do what you do are in New York or London or Paris, yeah. or whatever. Have you ever been tempted to go to one of those places and plant your flag there?
Absolutely never. and not even actually, and we're asked truly weekly to open and all around the country, and DC and Atlanta and Charleston and LA, and I mean truly always, constantly. And it has never been appealing to me because it's not about ego to me. It's not about, you know, I'm going to step and repeat this all over the country because I think it's so great. I think what I'm doing is serving Charlotte and serving my client here. And that's more than enough for me. It's a lot. I mean, it's a lot to handle. And I think that the reason we've been successful is because it's about Charlotte, and it's about this client and what's relevant to her, his and her life. You can't step and repeat that because I don't know the events in Richmond or, you know, Atlanta. I have no idea what they do, their season, or what's appropriate to wear to their events, because I know it, I actually think it's different from here, from the events I've gone to there. People don't look like we do.
Right.
So I actually think that's a really kind of the special sauce of what we do.
What advice would you give for people? I know you talked about, you know, when you were coming up, you didn't have a budget for this stuff,
yeah.
and you kind of figured out a way. There are obviously people who may not have the budget to shop at your stores.
Sure.
So what, you know, how do they make their way to this kind of stuff, or how do they figure it out for themselves if you don't have the money that your folks or yeah. your general customers do?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think thrift shops are my favorite place to shop. I mean, still, I love that. I think that's the very best place you see, and you see every designer, and also to do it online. eBay is an incredible place to find well-priced designer goods.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, take classes. I mean, try things, see people's reactions. I'm totally, open to, I think people should try things.
When you're laying around the house on a Sunday afternoon and the rest of us are wearing like t-shirts from some bar from 20 years ago and old sweatpants, what are you wearing?
I'm wearing sweatpants too. But it is funny because on Friday nights, my husband always wants to go somewhere near the store, which is near where I live. He always wants to go somewhere out to dinner. And I just have to say, I literally can't be that person right now. I've got to just cocoon out, and we could go up to the lake or something. So I don't know. We could go to Valentine, but I just can't be myself anymore at that moment. I can't like be the spokesperson for the store.
Do you feel like when you're out in the world that you are that? Like,
yeah.
Do you feel a need to be, I don't know if the right word is put together in some
absolutely.
Particular way.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm not a model, and I'm not my thinnest client, and I'm all of those things that I'm not my ideal model. And I think that's kind of the point. Everybody can look their best. You don't have to be perfect.
Right.
Because I'm really, really not. but I think that, yeah, I think, but everybody can look their best. I mean, everybody can probably do better.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I think
you look your best when you look like yourself. I mean, I think that's probably
right.
The main point is when you are really connected with who you are and what you're comfortable with. And I also think when you're comfortable and you're confident, and when you're confident, you look your most attractive.
Yeah. I want to kind of circle back around at the end. I assume that anybody who's listened this far thinks that fashion is and not style
turn, not turned it off yet.
Well, if they haven't turned it off yet, it's because they think that fashion and style is meaningful in some way. I know when I talk to people when I do sports writing, mm-hmm. and some people are like, "Well, I never read about sports," oh. and I'm like, "Well, it's not really about sports. No. It's about people, and sports can be this sort of proxy for how the world works and completely. All that sort of thing." And so I try with varying levels of success to explain why kind of sports is more than just sports.
Yeah.
So in your words, why does fashion, style, why does all that stuff matter?
It matters because it's the fastest way to tell the world about who you are on the inside. I mean, it is the first impression, as unfair as it is, that's how people come to know who you are. That's who they believe you are. And so if you're showing them something that's not really reflective of your insides, you're missing out on an opportunity to share who you are.
And as part of your job, I guess, to figure out
yeah.
who people are
yes,
before.
100%. Yeah. I mean, it's not about them being an image of me or our salespeople. It's about my stylist and of me helping them to figure out what makes them happy, what makes them feel confident, and ultimately what makes them feel beautiful.
And how do you do that?
Listen, you know, observe. Little things, you know, things they feel comfortable in, things they walk differently when they wear things that they feel pretty in. They stand taller, you know, they hold their shoulders back. I mean, it's all those little teeny cues that if you're listening and really watching that you can understand.
Laura, thank you so much for talking to
thank
me.
Thank you.
All right. Laura Van Rootpool wasn't dressed very fancy for our interview. She wore a striped shirt under a black blazer, maybe it was dark blue, and she wore old jeans and clogs. She looked comfortable. Her job is to make other people feel that way in the clothes that they wear. It struck me as she talked that her life has been a journey toward becoming comfortable in her own skin. As a woman, as a Southerner, as a business owner, as a prominent name in the fashion world, and most of all, as a member of a high-achieving family. All of us struggle to be our best selves. Not many of us get all the way there. But it's good to know that everybody's out there looking, trying on different versions of ourselves over the years, hoping to find the one that finally fits like a favorite old shirt. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Della Canale. Our web manager is Jennifer Lang. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. And our theme music comes from Josh Turner. If you have any thoughts about the show, ideas for future guests, or thoughts about cargo shorts as acceptable menswear, email me at ttomlinson, that's my first initial and last name, at wfae.org. You can listen to this and previous episodes of Southbound on WFAE.org, the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Also, between episodes, look for the Southbound Radio Hour with a playlist of music based on the most recent episode. You can find those on WFAE.org. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, committed to technology-driven radiation therapy and treatments for cancer. Details at treatcancer.com.